Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we have in the studio one of my favorite bands, or two members thereof, from Franz Ferdinand, Alex Kapranos, and Bob Hardy. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hello.
It's really great to have you here. It's especially exciting to have you here when you're about to release a very exciting new album. It's only your fifth studio album. You've released albums regularly, but not excessively. You've never been like it's 10 months later, here's the next album.
Yeah.
And this album is called Always Ascending. And it really is, I was saying to you guys before we started, it does feel a little bit like a reboot. And for once, that's not just a line. It actually, you guys have a different lineup now. It's changed a lot.
Sure, that's right. Julian Corey's joined the band, and Dino Bardot's joined us to play live as well. And so, yeah, things changed a little. Also, the last record we did was at the end of 10 years of the band's existence. It felt like the end of a decade, and this feels like the beginning of a new decade. And you know, it's still us, but it's maybe trying to do some different things.
You lost a member before you gained members, Nick McCarthy. I mean, Nick left the band, my understanding, is he basically has a family and was sick of touring. Is that
You know, he's got two kids, and the last of tours we did, you could see he was finding it really difficult, and he was missing the kids. And but we knew he was going to leave when we went off to do the FFS tour, and so it was kind of cool. We got to sort of come to appreciate it, and he got to enjoy that last tour and that last time we had together.
I mean, it's a major thing. You guys have been together since like 2002, and for him to come to you and say, I'm leaving the band, that's a heavy conversation. Do you remember that specific conversation?
Yeah, it wasn't an overnight thing. It was kind of, you know, the last few months, I guess, of touring our fourth album, it was kind of obvious he wasn't really enjoying being away from his family. And so it wasn't, you know, it didn't just happen. It was kind of a slow process. But when he finally said, okay, you know, I don't want to go on the road again, so he's going to buy out of making the next record. I guess there was a short period of time where it was kind of like, oh, that's, wow, what are we going to do? You know,
it's a big thing. You've got to be supportive as well. You know, like he's your friend, and you want the best for him.
How would you describe what Nick's role was in the band and what hole that left before we get to how you sort of filled it?
He was the guitarist and backing singer.
Well, yes. Yes, but...
Yeah. Sorry, yes. I know. No.
Yeah. At a creative level. Yeah.
The way bands like this work is it's a bunch of friends. It's a bunch of friends that hang out and so come up with ideas together and make stuff up. Mm. And the way I think about it is, you go out to the pub, you go out to a bar, and you've got your social group of friends, your people that you hang out with, and some nights one guy will be there but not there the next time, but still the same kind of social group, and the same, and you have a good laugh together, and it's the same in a band.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, he was a big part of the band, obviously. You know, he's there from the beginning, and I don't think when Julian came to join the band, he wasn't trying to replace Nick. He was just, you know, it wasn't any kind of,
yeah, he came to the band as Julian
to do that. Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, it's Julian Corey, is that the correct
name? Yeah, Julian, he made music under the name of Meow Meow for a few years. He put out some records on Chemical Underground, based in Glasgow. Yeah, cool guy.
And let's hear the title track of Always Ascending to get a sense of where you landed, because it's a recognizable place, but a different place. And it's funny, Alex, I was looking at an interview we did in 2005. We were all so young. And
you were younger.
And you were just about to release your second album at that point.
Yeah.
And you were talking about great bands manage the trick of evolving sometimes radically, yet always sounding like themselves.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, something you've managed to do, and something you've, at the same time, like every artist, puzzled with trying to figure out how one does that.
Man,
right?
That's the holy grail, you know, like to make records that sound totally different, but you can still tell it's you. Your identity stays the same.
And I think you've done it. Let's hear Always Ascending, the title track. So obviously an element of electronics has entered the band. Explain how all that worked.
Sure. I mean, we'd always had synthesizers and sort of played a bit with electronics, but maybe we went a bit further. Our third album had quite a strong electronic element. But
Tonight, yeah.
Yeah. With this one, I guess what we wanted to do is take the kind of parts that you would normally program into a sequencer and have those sonics, those sounds, but play them as a band. So what you're hearing there is the sort of that range, that sonic range that you'd normally find on a dance record, but played by a band. Everything you hear is the sound made by four guys in a room playing wow. together, you know.
And Julian's roots are sort of in techno, right?
He's definitely from an electronic. Like a lot of my friends who make electronic music, they still love rock and roll at the same time. And that's Julian too. But the stuff he made with Meow Meow was really electronica.
But also very melodic as well. He's like a big fan of, you know, beautiful melodies.
And Philippe Zadar, did I pronounce his last name correctly?
That's beautiful.
Yeah. I nailed it. he's worked with people like Phoenix and is very good at walking this line that I think you guys wanted to walk.
Sure, yeah. Like, if you hear the records he made, like, whether it's the Phoenix one or the Beastie Boys one or even the Cassius stuff that he does himself, they're all quite different in their sounds, but there's two ends of electronic music. There's the end that can be quite cold and human and machine-like, which is cool, and I appreciate that kind of thing, but his end is much more human and emotional, and yeah, I guess that's the end that we like to occupy as well.
I think that right before, not counting FFS, which was your collaboration with Sparks, which I'm sure was a sort of a lifetime dream that you couldn't even imagine being a dream, but your album was Right Thoughts, Right Words, Right Action. And I think right before that album, which kind of was a return to the sound of your first album, I think you'd say, before that album, I think you've said that you were close to breaking up.
Well, you know, I think Bob and I needed to talk about a few things, so we did. Mm. We went to Orkney and sorted it all out. But, you know, all bands have that, yeah. I think. You know.
I think it comes from living together on the road for however many years you're doing it. Now it's quite intense and you need to kind of make sure that, yeah.
It's like having housemates or flatmates, you know.
That's kind of like the emotional labour of being in a band. I think we had neglected for a period of time, but yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about, you know, like many journalists, I was lucky enough to go on the road with you once. You know, it was an overnight from the Netherlands back to the UK, you know, a 12-hour ride and getting out in the middle of the night for the customs people. And that was just one night that I experienced with you. And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, there's been 12 years of that for you guys and how it must be all sorts of things. It's still exhilarating. It must sometimes be utterly wearying. Mm. What are your overall kind of feelings about just life on the road? Because that is what you've ended up committing to in some ways.
Yeah, I know that going through passport control has lost its novelty now. I love it. You know, it's still exciting to go to all these cities around the world, and there are still places that you go to for the first time. No, I can't think of anything I'd rather do, and that thrill and that exhilaration that you have on a stage is totally astonishing.
And at the same time, there's the thing of, you know, when you're doing your fifth album or whatever it is, finding the inspiration and energy like it's your first. And I imagine sometimes that's difficult and sometimes it's less difficult. How was that this time?
It felt very easy making this record. I guess we're all getting on and having a laugh. You know, if you're having a laugh, if you're enjoying yourselves, if you're enjoying hanging out with each other, it's kind of easy to make a record. And I think you can always hear it when you listen to a record, if a band's had a good time. No matter how dark the subject matter of the songs are, if the band has enjoyed making it, you get a thrill and a buzz from listening to it. And as for how do you do that? Well, it just happens. You know, you can't really plan that sort of thing. It's just it is that way or it isn't. And maybe treat your fellow band members with respect. Maybe that's part of it.
Was there an awkwardness to having a new person there? Was it a constructive awkwardness that thing we have to be a little more polite? We can't be our usual assholes if this new person is here. Or how does that work? Just almost on a social and creative level.
We remain being the assholes we will always be.
Good.
I think the fact that it wasn't awkward at all was kind of the indicator that Julian would be a good fit. You know, we he'd been recommended to us by friends. Stuart Braithwaite from Mogwai and Emma Pollock and Paul Savage from the Delgados kind of independently said, you know, Julian Corry, have you thought about asking working with him? So we met him for dinner, and it was totally, you know, relaxed and enjoyable kind of
had
social event.
Had a few drinks.
Had a few drinks. Went down to the studio, played in what we've been working on. Yeah, went to the pub, came back and just played music together, and it felt very natural. And his, you know, his reference point, his cultural reference points, you know, are all this big crossover with us. You know, it was just very, very, felt very comfortable.
I think the fact that both Julian and Dino are from Glasgow as well helps a lot, and it makes it easier because, like Bob says, we have the same frame of reference. And the Glaswegian sense of humour is quite a dark one, and to have somebody that can understand that you're not a psychopath, you're just being funny, definitely helps.
And is Dino a full member as well now? Or
yeah, Dino's touring with us all the time. Like, he's in New York right now with us, and he's a good guy. We've known Dino for a long time. Like, he'd played in various bands we knew, like V-Twin and things. So
when you went in and played music with Julian that first night, what does that mean? Do you mean you jammed, or what?
No,
is that?
We played him a song that we had written and sort of made a demo of, but never performed as a band because we didn't, you know, we didn't have
the
lineup. And so we played him it, and he was like, "Oh, I like that." And then he was like, "So should we have a go at playing it live?" And he'd heard it like once, and he could just play it straight away on the piano, and that was kind of impressive. We were giving each other side eye, kind of like, "What the."
But it's nice, and you feel it as well. You know instinctively and instantly if something's right. It just feels good.
Yeah. And I think he when he'd been doing his music under Meow Meow, which had a couple of records on Chemical Underground, it had just been a solo artist. So he hadn't had the band experience, I guess, recently as we had.
Yeah.
So he was getting off on the playing with other people as well. It's nice.
What's your glimpse of love, and then we'll maybe play the other one. And this is cool because actually the world has not really heard that song.
I think that's the premiere.
Yeah, I'm A&Ring for you. I guess I chose that as your single.
But cheers.
I was interested in the lyrics that love is going to come as a photographer. You know, I was wondering if it's about a sort of Instagram famous celebrity or something. I was wondering where you were going with that.
You're definitely on the right lines. We wrote that song by going, you know, some of the online tabloid news sites, you have these sidebars and you have all these news stories about female celebrities. And we took all the lines in the song, apart from the chorus, are taken. So that line that you heard there, not that one actually, but later in the song, we all the lines are taken from headlines that you would see in those sidebars of the tabloid sites. And they're, you know, they're very objectifying. Brutal, and when you take them out of the context of those sidebars, they're quite brutal and really ugly and quite disturbing. And then, so when you listen to the song, you kind of wonder, oh, what's this song about? And you think it's maybe just a song about love, and then you enter the actual disturbing world of the source.
And now let's hear the actual second single, "Feel the Love Go."
No, you're not that thing that you're doing. For the things that you do are not who you are. Why don't you come over here? Why don't you come over here? Why don't you come over here?
So it's a little more existential or or life advice or sarcastic life advice, I'm not sure.
No, that's not sarcastic.
Yeah, I mean, think of a friend and wish them love. Think of an enemy and wish them more. Where are these thoughts coming from?
They're coming from Bob.
Well, it's the loving. I was going to a Buddhist meditation class.
Aha. See, that makes much more sense than Alex. I feel like.
And it's kind of like a riff on the kind of loving kindness meditation.
Mm.
It's a cliched guy in a band going to.
And what made you think of that one as a single?
When you make a record, we had this rule actually when we were making this record that nobody would mention singles, that you wouldn't talk about singles, because as Philippe puts it, all the other songs become jealous if you name the single is, which is such a good attitude. And so to choose the singles, what we do is play the record to our friends or our family, and like the ones that people respond to, you know, that's it kind of becomes obvious at that point. and you know, people like that song, and what's interesting as well is that we didn't really think of that song as a single. In fact, we weren't even sure we were going to put it on the record, but when we recorded it, because we recorded in Paris, and the guys from Domino in Paris came round to the studio, and they were losing their brains over it, and they were
but in general, you've always walked this line, I think, between some of the more underground and avant-garde taste that you may have and your love for the 3 to 4 minute pop song.
Yeah.
And how does that balance work for you, and how does it shift over time, or how has it shifted?
I think it's the ultimate challenge is to sneak the avant-garde or some more radical ideas into the context of a pop song. And I kind of admire artists that do that. Like I love like a band like the KLF, for example, that really, you know, they were fairly confrontational and had some pretty wild ideas, but still they were number one in the charts in the UK. And yeah, I loved that. I don't know. Bob, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think that maybe my idea of what a pop song is has kind of broadened over the last 15 years as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, songs like Always Ascending are definitely not like conventional pop songs in their structure. Like, you know, it's like 5.5 minutes long, and it's something I don't think we would have put a 5.5 minute song on our first or second or third record. Or actually, in the third record, did have a very long song. But yeah, it's something I think that we're now kind of more open to, kind of changing our idea of what that is.
I was reading this book by David Byrne, How Music Works.
Oh, yes.
Which is really interesting. Yeah, yeah. And he has some points he makes that seem obvious, and then you think more about them, and actually they're quite profound also. And there's a chapter about context in music.
Right.
And how both the context that what you're writing for, the place you imagine it being listened to, and also the larger context. And, you know, the world has changed so much as far as music since you guys started. You know, that 12 years or whatever is an eternity in pop music. And even the very idea of what a pop song is has changed maybe for younger people. So how at all does that affect the way you write, the way you arrange, the way you do everything?
It's fascinating the way things have changed. And one of the big changes in context in our lifetime as a band is the way that the album and single balance has completely been transformed. Everything was about the album when we started out. Now everything is about the single. It's about standalone tracks. I don't even know if single's the right word, but just songs that exist in their own right. And maybe I do like the idea that you can appreciate a song in its own right, but I also still am a fan of a body of work that you can't convey all of your ideas just within one song. And so maybe that's going against what the current trends are rather than trying to follow them.
I want to play a bit of a song called Lois Lane, which is, you know, there's a proud tradition of rock songs with Lois Lane in them. There's, you know,
all right.
Pocketful of Kryptonite by the Spin Doctors. And some other good ones. Yeah, yeah. And let's hear Lois Lane a little bit.
Lois Lane seemed a pretty strong woman, the kind of woman that a girl could be. So you got an H&D in journalism, because journalism could change the world. And if you change the world, then you could be happy. Yeah, you could be happy. Choices.
We didn't get to my favorite part of the song, which I wanted to talk to you about. At the over 30 singles night, it's bleak, it's bleak, it's bleak. See you next week. It's so catchy and it's so dark and kind of hilarious. Where did that bit come from?
I did have experience of like going to one. When I was about 24, I was staying in this flat in Glasgow. And I had a flatmate who was a bit older than me. He was about 28 or 29. And he had a friend who was a bit older yet. And he had his 30th birthday. And as a joke, we all went round to the over 30 singles night in the hotel around the corner. And it just seemed like the most depressing thing in the world to me at that age of 24. The idea of being over 30. Never mind single. Yeah, I'm over 30 now, listeners.
Yeah.
A long way over 30.
Getting a little bit older in rock and roll, how does that sit with you? How do you feel about it?
I think it was a lot harder in the 50s or 60s to be over the age of 22 and still playing in a band. Now, because quite a few folk have aged before us, you know, and still, of course, he's in our minds still all the time. But if you look at somebody like Bowie making that incredible record just before his 70th birthday when he died, it's obvious to anybody that you can maintain a high level of creative impetus and maintain it throughout your life.
Have you thought about, especially now that you've got perhaps a new lease on life for this band, have you thought about it? Is this something that could possibly span decades, that you just keep going and keep going? Because I'm not sure if initially you were so sure. You'd been in so many bands and done so many things, it may have been just another project starting out. So how do you see it now?
I mean, we got a tour. I've just got my head on this tour, really. We're playing a lot of dates this year. Should come to shows in April.
Bob looks so terrified right now.
I don't want to plan my life, past September, past my tour dates that I've got listed currently.
I've always been bad at planning ahead. I'm the kind of guy that would get a diary for my Christmas and then sort of like write, sort of stop putting entries in after January the 7th. And, I'm not good at planning for the future. And maybe that's how you stay sane in this world as well, by not thinking about the future too much.
When I interviewed you and when I interviewed a lot of bands that I really liked back in the 2000s, I had this template before me from an earlier era where it kind of was like, oh, this is a great band. They might be as big as, U2 or REM or something. And it turned out that the way things would go for the most part, other than, Coldplay or somebody, that it's a little different. That's not even on the menu anymore to become, U2. The triumph like you guys have is having a career, being quite a well-known band without sort of quote-unquote conquering the world, or even the key part of things is really even wanting to.
Yeah. I know when we got a band together, nobody mentioned conquering anything, and that was never the desire. I think to get to that kind of level of playing stadiums and that being your life, you really have to want to do it. And I don't know if that's, we really have the obsession with that to get there.
Yeah, I think it's different now as well with the way that the internet makes it more, all your fans are just so much closer. So you might, your fan base feels very close and very intense, but it's like quality over quantity, It's kind of like, you can play a show to like a big theatre show or whatever, but everyone there, really into your band because they found you, because they can find you. Whereas it's like, there's so many different music, so much different music available and so much different avenues to find it that people can splinter off into many different ways. So when they do find what they love, they kind of really dedicate themselves to it.
You've avoided nostalgia. You've managed to move forward. It's funny, there is a time of, as you may have been hearing on this press tour, it's a time of a little bit of sort of mid-2000s nostalgia.
Oh, is there?
Yes, it's a thing.
I'm just managing to get my head around the 90s revivalism, never mind the 2000s.
A friend and colleague of mine wrote a book that was quite big in the U.S., Meet Me in the Bathroom.
That's a great book. Lizzie's book.
And it inspired a lot of sort of, I think it's both part of and inspired independently, just a lot of thinking about that era and the quote-unquote rock revival you guys were never really part of, but perhaps were vaguely associated here with.
I guess if there were any sort of parallels, we were closer to what bands like The Rapture and LCD Sound System, where they were coming from. But we toured with Interpol. That was our first tour. It was opening up for Interpol in the UK, and they're cool guys, and it was nice to sort of make a connection there.
You guys were, and this is actually something I wrote about you in my very first article, which was for Entertainment Weekly. It was when the first album came out, that the British press was always finding these debut albums and saying they were actually one of the greatest debuts of all time.
And this time they got it right.
Yeah, that's literally what I said. That's what I said, and I stand by it.
Yay!
What I said is they're almost always wrong. Sorry, gay dad, which was me. And nice guys. But you made a extremely uncommonly great first album, which is a blessing and a curse in some ways, right? Or how do you guys see it?
We didn't set out to make a masterpiece.
It just happened. We put our trousers on like everyone else in the world. Yeah, we get to work.
I don't know. The thing is as well that it wasn't really our first album. You know, I'd been in a few bands before. You know, and it's probably like my third or fourth album, really. As for it being a blessing or a curse, great. You know, I love it. People loved that record, and yeah, that it allowed us to continue making records and brought a lot of people to the band. And you know, you can't dictate how people understand or appreciate your music. Some people listen to it in a very shallow, passing sort of way, and some people get into the depth of it. You know, I don't care either way.
The odd thing with that album is that you were caught up in one of the reasons why the song Take Me Out was so successful in America was A, it's a great song, a classic song, and B, your label was paying it to the top.
But the thing is, it would have made no difference anyway. Like, it's so perverse. Like, that song yeah. was a hit in all the
international hit, not just America. Worldwide.
But I don't understand why they were doing that stuff. It seemed to belong to a completely different decade. You know?
Yeah.
But it obviously didn't. Maybe it still goes on. I don't know. But yeah, it just seemed to be the system. It was so embarrassing. I just remember all this stuff coming out, and it's like yeah, it was us. And but the other thing was that it was just, I can't remember who was doing the investigation. They just happened to pick on Epic, who were distributing our label for Domino at the time. And if they had picked any label, they would have found exactly the same stuff, because every label in the States was doing exactly the same thing at that time.
See, my take on that is, you know, if indeed it gave it any boost in America, that's a good use of payola. why not use payola for good?
Yeah, yeah,
you know, to try to put him, because you know, it also the Modest Mouse album and song was also boosted at
that's
the time.
That's right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It created this sense, this completely false sense, unfortunately, that quote unquote alternative rock, as it was known in the United States, was on the rise again.
Right.
But alas, that commercially, you know, in the mainstream,
yeah.
But it turned out to be a blip. What's your Take Me Out for a moment, if we can? Has it ever been a sort of Radiohead's creep thing for you? Have you ever grown tired of that song?
yeah, that song's in my head. No, Lana Del Rey's never covered it. So, no, you hear stories about bands resenting songs that they've written in the past because they have become popular. And to me, that just seems absurd. If you're sick of playing the song, just don't play the song anymore and don't moan about it. You know, yeah, it's a good song to play. I like it.
What do you remember about writing it and recording it? Does it stick out at all?
Well, when we first wrote it, we couldn't get the tempo right. The verses sounded better played a little bit faster, and the choruses sounded better played a little bit slower, and we could never quite work it out. And then one day I had this idea that, right, guys, we're going to take all the verses, put them at the beginning of the song, then we're going to slow down and play all the choruses, which is kind of the wrong way to do it, but it kind of works in that song.
Bob, I was looking at our old interview from 2005, and at the time, at least, you were a very instinctive player. You didn't know any scales.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yeah. I'm not very good at scales.
Yeah, yeah. I was curious, after all these years, have you... has that changed at all? Have you sort of studied more formally?
I got like Bass Guitar for Dummies book. It really, really changed the way I played.
He's not lying either.
And it made things make a lot more sense. But I had to reach the point where I had to realize that, I am a bass player. I'm a bass player in a band. I better actually learn how to do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I downloaded the book.
Because you like to pretend for a really long time that you weren't a musician.
Well, I was more invested in the social aspects of being in a band, I think, than the technique of playing the bass. I'm not a big music fan, obviously. But at some point in the last, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, I guess, I kind of thought I'd give it a go.
That's somewhat hilarious. And
one thing I did notice, actually, after I... because I didn't play an instrument growing up, but I was a huge Beatles fan. And I growing up, listening to the Beatles, never really listening to the bass lines, and then having learned how to play the bass and being a bass player in a band, going back and listening to Paul McCartney and the Beatles, and you're like, bloody hell, this is incredible, you know, what he's doing. I never really appreciated that before.
And to jump back to Franz Ferdinand's new album, or just about to release new album, Always Ascending, let's hear another really interesting, great song called The Academy Award, which tackles some subject matter. It's funny, I'm talking a lot about David Byrne because I interviewed him and was dived deep, and he had a great line that you've already taken to heart, which is he wants to tell bands and songwriters, please don't just write about your girlfriends and boyfriends. It's a big world. There's so many things to write about. And as I was thinking about your lyrics, I think you have the same idea.
Yeah. I very rarely write about my girlfriends. They don't like it.
With a couple famous exceptions, yes. But yes,
they didn't like it.
let's hear the Academy Award.
For good times goes to you. Yeah, the Academy Award for good times goes to you. Ooh, there's a camera held in every hand, the clamor of applause in every mind, but the Academy Award for good times goes to you.
So then the next line is show me the body, hikikomori, which is, we were saying, is a term I'm fairly sure has never been used in at least an English language song before. And of course, it's the Japanese term for a kind of shut-in who lives in their parents' basement and plays a lot of video games and watches anime, of which we now have many in the United States and elsewhere in the world. And this whole song gets at the idea of the sort of panopticon that everyone's created, this sense of observing and being observed seems to be part of it. Yeah. But don't let me explain it, please.
I guess the sort of a collage of all those places, and it's amazing that Japanese term which Bob discovered, which, you know, it sums up a specific social phenomenon in Japan, but we see it everywhere where people are communicating through their devices more than they are in real life. And the chorus there, it's singing about, I'm singing about how we, for the first time in human history, we walk around with a movie camera in our pockets all the time, and as a result we're performing this role for those cameras, and you get an Academy Award for a performance, you know, for a performance of a role, and in this case the Academy Award for good times is the performance of a good time that we have, not actually having a good time, but the role of a good time, the semblance of a good time.
Have you noticed people in your audiences who seem to be filming themselves enjoying the band? that is a thing now where people are more.
Yes, I have seen that. Yeah.
What do you make of that?
It's an odd thing to see from stage. Yeah. I guess everybody's doing it. It is. I don't know. Have you noticed it, Bob?
Yeah, I've noticed it. I don't mind. It doesn't really bother me. And like some bands that they kind of, you know, get annoyed when people are on their cell phones or taking photos at gigs. But I quite like it. For me, it feels like that's just like the ripples out nowadays from a gig. It's like not contained in that room. It kind of ripples throughout like people's Instagram stuff. And I quite like that kind of. It feels like an event.
I'm trying to think of the way that I behave when I'm at a gig, and of course you do have the instinct to record a bit of what you're at, the experience that you have. I know what I do is if I ever do film a gig, I always like hold a camera against my chest so I'm not looking at the screen, so it just captures whatever it is, because I hate the idea that I'm somehow enjoying the experience through the LCD screen of my phone rather than being there in the moment. The first time I noticed it was I went to see Kraftwerk a few years ago at the Turbine Hall in London, and they had this incredible 3D show, and there was a guy 3 feet away from him, from me, filming the whole thing on a massive tablet, like an iPad type thing. I was like, why are you doing this? He was looking at the whole show through his tablet. I was like, you're not going to be able to watch this when you go home because it's 3D. You need the damn specs. You know, like, and you've got to give them back at the end of the show, man. You know that, don't you? You can't keep them. And yeah, it really summed up the perversity of that situation.
And there's a line in the song we were just talking about, through liquid crystal, we look at the world. So
yeah,
that guy made an impression on you. We sometimes do a thing on the show, maybe we'll call it Rockstars React, where we play a new single that's not by them. The last time we did it, I think we played Alice Cooper, the new Taylor Swift song, which he had a surprising number of thoughts about, actually. And in a perhaps equally incongruous, maybe less incongruous juxtaposition, maybe we'll play a little bit of the new Justin Timberlake single, which is called Supplies. And I'm personally, it comes from a weird place. It has a survivalist bent. It's a survivalist Justin Timberlake song. So let's maybe hear that and hear what these guys think of it.
Okay. Met you out on Broadway on the hottest night in town. We arrived solo, but we were being chased around. Saw you being cornered by some guy you used to know. Stepped in between the both of y'all said I'm
That's nuts. Has he got one of those buckets, you know, that you get the what do you call those guys? Well, they're the ones that prepared for the apocalypse. They have the buckets with all the
survivalist guys.
So, yeah. Is that what he is now? Is he a survivalist?
Preppers, is that what we call them. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Well, I think... I have no idea, man.
I like it. I like the music. Yeah, it's cool.
I like that percussive kind of like voices.
Yeah, I like the. Thing. Yeah, yeah. I can't do that. Whatever.
Yeah, and it's wordy. I like wordy songs.
Yeah. I think he's got that kind of thing like ABBA had back in the 70s, where he's very capable of taking current trends and pushing them a bit further. I've always liked him. He's a great singer. But I do like to imagine him like sort of like out in the Rocky Mountains or something like that, like getting ready for, decking out his bunker.
So, you know, as we were discussing, one of the things with your new album, which has very little survivalism in it, is this not quite newfound because you played with it before, but electronic elements. And, you know, Julian, your new member of your band, is, as we said, has a sort of techno background. And I was remembering, Alex, that you studied computers, and part of it was you were making your own computer music, you once told me. What was that stuff like, if you recall?
It was. That's what drew me to study that at the time. God, it's kind of weird to think that all those years ago I could code and all that kind of thing. I couldn't even dream of starting that now. I guess I've always been fascinated with that and that side of music and the idea of bringing the two together and I'll have to pull some of it out. In fact, one of the songs, the basis of one of the songs, did end up on our second album from that period, the song Outsiders. That kind of started off from an idea that I had at that period.
Speaking of the second album, we were talking about sort of career arcs and all that kind of thing. Was there a time when you felt, especially after having, you know, a huge pop hits worldwide, when you were thinking about pressure and following up and career arcs and ascending and always ascending and that kind of thing? And do you think less about that now? Is it a different kind of goal? How does it all work for you?
I making that second album was pretty stressful in the end, and it not through pressure that we'd really put on ourselves, but we agreed to a tour. Like there was a tour booked for the United States, and then there was a release date set for the album, and then suddenly we thought, like, oh my god, we've only got like 6 months to finish this album, whatever. And I still like that record, and the songs are really good, but it was, you know, hard work making it.
You were saying that your producer not only had a great line of, if you know, if you make one song the single, the other songs get jealous, but also that he pisses on singles, he told you.
I piss on the idea of the single.
So is that now truly out of your mind about, like, quote unquote making a hit? Is that off your radar?
Making hits? Yeah. I've never in my life sat down to write a hit. I've sat down to write a song. And some of those songs have become hits, but you know, you don't write. I like writing songs. I like sort of, you know, and then recording them and playing them with my pals. That's it, you know. And I'm not knocking anybody who does sit down sort of deliberately to write hits. There's loads of guys that do that. There's loads of top line writers and that kind of thing. It's just different angle, different perspective you come at it from.
We were talking about the current climate of pop music. Have you learned anything from the mainstream pop and hip-hop of the last, you know, say 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, there's little things. Like, if you listen to the song Huck and Jim on this record, I know that the kind of like hi-hat patterns that you get in a lot of trap music, that sort of thing, which are very programmed. And what's cool about them is they sort of shift the swing of the beat like halfway through a bar and that kind of stuff. We thought, oh, that's really cool. But I've never heard a band playing that. It's always programmed. And so I know Paul was playing with that a lot on this record, and you hear it in Huck and Jim. Like that's our, you know, weird white Glaswegian way of trying to play something like that.
You read my mind. That's actually where I was going. So let's play a little bit of Huck and Jim, which is a really cool song. So again, that might have been a world premiere of Huck and Jim from the next French
Friend. It was.
Sipping 40s with Huck and Jim, where did that image come from?
Well, yeah, the first line of that chorus is, we're going to America, going to tell them about the NHS. And the song just sounded the most American thing we'd ever done, like sonically. And I was kind of joking about going to America at first, then talking about the NHS because we love the NHS and it's being dismantled in the UK, and it's what I talk about with a lot of my American friends, the idea of healthcare and the idea that it's, you know, the heart of civilization, looking after your sick. And then I wanted to pick a character from history or literature or my experience that summed up America, and the first figure that popped in my head was Huckleberry Finn. And then I realized that well, it's not, that book's not just about him, it's about him and Jim. And yeah, those two figures sum up America in quite a few ways.
Mm. It's an interesting image. So this has been Alex and Bob from Franz Ferdinand. It's been delightful to have them here. Their new album, Always Ascending. And this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt, and we'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, download us as a podcast. Subscribe to us as a podcast and leave us a review if you can. See you next week.